Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. One of the many things I love about D&D 5th Edition is the ease with which you can create balanced encounters. Today, I set off again on the Obsidian Monolith to create the first encounters in my new D&D campaign, and I take you along for the ride. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. Hello, listener. Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 64 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. It's really great to be back behind the mic, and it's even more great to be over my flu that I had. Ugh. Yeah, I made a couple episodes while I had flu, and I thought I sounded all right, but my wife listened and she said I sounded really sick. So hopefully it wasn't too painful to listen to. Today I am doing something a little different for the show. We'll see how it's received. Definitely let me know what you think at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. And a question that I see asked a lot about the new edition of D&D is how you create encounters. And you know, there's a lot of levels and layers to that question, right? There's just the mechanical, how do I know which creatures or monsters to use for a party of X number of players of X level, or, you know, just the mechanical, like how do I build a balanced encounter that will be the level of challenge that I want for my players? And another part of it is, how do I take an encounter that I've created as far as monsters and stats and turn that into something interesting that ties into my story? And another part of that is, you know, how do you just make encounters interesting, and how do you decide what to do for encounters? So there's a lot involved, and, you know, different people asking the question probably are looking for different answers. But I thought it would be fun, while I was working on some encounters for my new D&D campaign, to hook up the mic and just kind of talk to you as I'm doing it and kind of explain what I'm doing. And maybe it will be helpful for new GMs out there, especially new GMs wanting to run the new D&D and wondering how you do this. For those of you that are interested in my world building episodes, this might also be of interest to you, because I am creating encounters for my first campaign that I'm running in my brand new D&D world of Primordia. So I talk a little bit about what I'm thinking and what I'm planning for the campaign and how I'm designing it and things like that, and special considerations to bear in mind because of the details of my world, which of course is something else when you're creating encounters and adventures and campaigns that you want to think of, is the setting that you're playing in and how you can bring that in as much as possible. But before I get into all that, I want to thank a new patron that has joined the Star Walker Studios Patreon over at patreon.com/StarWalkerStudios. So huge shout out and thank you to Steven Strickland. Thank you so much, Steven, for your support. I really appreciate it. Also, I wanted to let you guys know about a really cool series of videos that I saw online that is D&D and RPG related. It's called Roll for the Summer Campaign, and it's a fantasy series about four friends who are playing D&D or something very much like it together, and it's kind of a combination of their adventures in the actual campaign and their dealing with each other as players and people. I've seen a few different movies like this, and some of them are better than others. This one is definitely one of the better, if not the best, videos like this that I've seen. It was really entertaining and really well done. So you can check that out at roll4.com, and that's ROLLFOUR.com, Or just head to the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com and I'll have a link to the videos there. Definitely check them out. They're really cool. All right, so now I'm going to sit down at the gaming table here at the Obsidian Monolith, and I'm going to start working on my D&D adventure. All right, so I am getting ready to prepare the first adventure in my new world, and thought I would just record this. Maybe it'll be helpful to someone. So I've made a list of CR2 monsters from the Monster Manual that I think sound interesting. And I was looking through them and there's quite a few undead and just scary things. So I think I will do a kind of horror themed adventure. And Halloween's coming, so it'll be right in season. So why not? And also, I think that low level is my favorite time to do horror stuff because things are more scary because the PCs aren't that powerful yet. So it's a great time to do this kind of adventure while they're still vulnerable. They don't have any magic items to protect them. All right, so the Gibbering Mouther sounds pretty cool. Of all the terrors created by foul sorcery, gibbering mouthers are among the most wicked and depraved. This creature is the composite eyes, mouths, and liquefied matter of its former victims. Yes. Driven to insanity by the destruction of their bodies and absorption into the mouther, those victims gibber incoherent madness, forced to consume everything in reach. So that sounds awesome. That sounds really scary. Definitely a good boss encounter, for lack of a better term. Something that will be scary and, yeah, all by itself. So let's see. Now I wonder, you know, mechanically, is this creature interesting? So I always look first for, you know, any special abilities. It has an amoeboid form. Its body is an amorphous mass of mouths and eyes that propels itself by oozing forward, fastening several mouths to the ground and pulling its bulk behind. That's just freaky. This is so awesome. This is going to be so great for this. Mouths of madness. When it senses its prey, its mouths begin to murmur and chatter, each with a different voice, deep or shrill. Oh my gosh, that'll be fun to describe. Wailing or ululating. Crying out in agony or ecstasy, or both at the same time, which would be even more disturbing. This cacophonous gibbering overcomes the senses of any creature that hears it, causing most to flee in terror. Others are overcome with madness or stand paralyzed. Okay, so there's got to be some mechanics for that, right? That sounds pretty cool. All-consuming, driven to devour any creature it can reach, a gibbering mouther flows over victims, transfixed by its mad ranting. Its multitudinous voices temporarily silence as it gnaws and swallows living flesh. Ooh, the monster liquefies stone with which it comes into contact, hindering creatures that overcome its gibbering and attempt to flee. Cool, so let's see what these mechanics are like. We've got, it's got dark vision 60 feet. It's immune to the prone condition, of course. So aberrant ground. The ground in a 10-foot radius around the mouther is doe-like difficult terrain. So that's cool. So basically, if I remember how that works, they basically, it takes twice as much movement to go the same distance. So, yeah. If I decide to use, like, miniatures, that'll definitely be a thing. If we're just doing Theater of the Mind, that is a lot less cool. Though it could come into play. Oh, now here we go. Each creature that starts its turn in the area must succeed on a DC 10 strength saving throw or have its speed reduced to zero until the start of its next turn. So that's cool. Okay, so that would even apply in Theater of the Mind. So Theater of the Mind, basically, if you're in melee or you're engaged with this thing, you're having to make this saving throw or you can't move. So you can't run away. That's pretty cool. And then gibbering, the mouther babbles incoherently while it can see any creature
and isn't incapacitated. Each creature that starts its turn within 20 feet of the Mauther and can hear the gibbering must succeed on a DC 10 wisdom saving throw. On a failure, the creature can't take reactions until the start of its next turn and rolls D8. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay, so that's like almost like a confusion or insanity kind of thing. You roll a die and the person does random things depending on what you roll, or they do nothing. Okay, on a 7 or... So you roll a D8. I guess I can just say, since I might release this on a podcast. So you roll a D8, and on a 1 to 4... the creature does nothing. So 50% chance they just do nothing. On a 5 or 6, they take no action or bonus action and use all of their movement to move in a randomly determined direction. And then 7, 8, they make a melee attack against a randomly determined creature within reach. And if there's no one within reach, they just do nothing. So that's pretty cool. And I like the aberrant ground thing, if you want to melee with it, is a strength saving throw, and the gibbering is a wisdom saving throw. So I like that because different characters can shine in different ways. You know, people with good wisdom saves will be better protected against the gibbering and more likely to actually be able to do something. And then the people with good strength saves can actually get up into melee and fuck this thing up. Oh, it has multi-attack. Makes one bite attack, and if it can, uses Blinding Strike, or Blinding Spittle, which spits a chemical glob at a point it can see within 15 feet. Explodes in a blinding flash of light. Each creature within 5 feet of the flash must make a DC 13 dex save or be blinded until the end of the Mauther's next turn. Oh man, this thing is harsh. Maybe I shouldn't throw this at level 2, because this is a CR2. So I was thinking of doing an encounter just with the Gibbering Mauther, or with the Gibbering Mauther and maybe some minions. But already I'm thinking definitely it should just be the Mauther, because this thing is badass. Although, let's see, armor class 9, so it's really easy to hit. 67 hit points at level 2. Yeah. So I guess it'd take a party wailing on it a few rounds to kill it, maybe. Well, and that's without factoring in, that's just looking at armor class and hit points. Like, then you start factoring in aberrant ground and the gibbering, like, if they're failing those saves, they can't move or they can't do anything, or they're attacking each other. So, it'd probably survive a few rounds just as is. Because what I'm thinking is, if I want to do this by itself, I want it to be like a dramatic encounter, right? I want this thing, I mean, this thing is scary, right? And I want it, when they actually fight it, I want it to be scary to fight as well. You know, I don't want them to kill it in like one round, because that'll be really anticlimactic and be like, oh, we were afraid of this thing and it was nothing, right? I'm thinking definitely, I just want to throw this by itself. I don't want any minions, because I'm afraid it might kill players. Just depends how they save. I mean, if they get bad rolls on saves, I mean, this encounter could go really bad. We'll have to see, huh? Hopefully, it shouldn't be too much. They're level 2. It's CR2. I mean, by the system, what the system says, they should have a good chance of being able to defeat it. So we shall see. But what I was thinking is maybe I might want to give it some extra hit points if I do use it, because, you know, if they're rolling well or decent, you know, I don't want them to kill it in like one or two rounds. I'd rather it's a more pitched battle. So 67 hit points. I don't know. That'd probably take a few rounds. I mean, I could always on the fly during the game add hit points, but I hate to do that. I feel like I'm cheating if I do that. I'd rather, you know, while I'm designing the adventure or whatever, just anticipate and be like, okay, they're going to kill this thing too fast, so I'm going to give it some extra hit points. And then if the battle is going bad and I decide, okay, I'm going to go back to what it says in the monster manual and take away those extra hit points, then I don't feel like I'm cheating, right? I'm just going back to the default. I'm like, okay, they can't handle my souped up monster. I know I had an experience running Numenera, one of my Obsidian Monolith adventures, and I was using Slicer Beetles against the players, and it was kind of like this. Like, I was like, I wanted it to be a scary encounter. Like, I wanted the players to be genuinely frightened that their characters might die. And it was effectively, I think, the first combat encounter of the campaign, at least for some of the characters. Some of the characters did like a prelude thing that had combat, but for the actual Obsidian Monolith campaign, this was the first combat. And I overdid it because I souped up the Slicer Beetles a little bit because I was afraid they wouldn't be challenging enough by themselves. So first of all, I had quite a few of them. And second of all, I just made them more powerful. I advanced them. I forget what the term is in Numenera, but they have like a advancement package or whatever you can put on a thing. And I think I did that. Or maybe I just raised this level one or something. I mean, it wasn't a huge change, but Slicer Beetles are already a lot scarier than I thought they were. But it's really hard to balance encounters in Numenera because the level of the creature doesn't really tell you the whole story of how dangerous it is. You have to really like look at what the thing can do and think about how that would interact with your party and decide how dangerous you think it is. Because certain things are a lot more dangerous than just their level would indicate. Long story short, I was smart enough to realize right away that fighting a bunch of these things was going to be too much. So the way I did it was the PCs were mainly interacting with like one Slicer Beetle, and the rest of them were fighting these other creatures around them. But just the one Slicer Beetle like almost killed everybody, and they just ran away, barely got away. So I don't want that to happen with the Gibbering Mouth there, because I don't want to go crazy. So I think I'm just going to run it as it is. And if they're really just annihilating it and it's going to be just like a bummer encounter because it dies too quickly, I'll just add hit points on the fly if I have to. But I think as is, it's going to take them a few rounds, probably three or four rounds at least, to deal with it. Because, unless they just roll really well on their saves and everybody saves against everything, that, you know, they're going to have things to cope with, and they're not going to be able to all just pile damage on this thing every turn. So, and maybe, my PCs won't all be like combat oriented. But kind of the way I think I'm going to set up the way adventurers work in my world, they probably will be more combat oriented, but maybe not, because I could definitely see adventurers that are just focused on, being the one that knows things or being the one that can get you in anywhere. There's a lot of things involved other than combat. And if you have someone that's really good at one of those things, it's worth having them with you, even if they're no good in combat. All right. So this thing's got multi-attack, it can bite, and then it can do Blinding Spittle. The Blinding Spittle does have a recharge of 5-6. And that one's a dex save to avoid blindness. So I love this. Okay, we've got, if you're in melee, you're making a strength save to avoid being like having your speed reduced to zero. Everyone's making wisdom saves against the gibbering sound to avoid just standing there drooling on yourself or attacking whoever's closest to you. And then we've got the Blinding Spittle with a dex save. So if someone gets hit with that, it's a dex save. So I like that. I like that. Three different saves. Cool. So now I'm going to think about, I'm trying to actually plan out the first level because I'm starting the PCs at level 2. So I'm trying to plan out what encounters I can do before they level to level 3. Because I did the math, and if I just throw just a CR2 at them, I can do 5 of those before they level. But not every encounter is going to be just one CR2, because that would be boring and too predictable. So I'll probably do some encounters with multiple creatures of lower levels or whatever. My kind of strategy here is I'm wanting to do really cool set piece encounters. Like I
you know, I feel like I've really been slacking on like my descriptions and just like really getting into the flavor and what's going on around other than just the mechanics and resolving that. And I want to get more into the story. So, you know, D&D is very much geared around encounters. And, you know, yeah, a lot of these are going to end up being combat encounters because that's kind of the game. Like, that's what D&D is about. You know, if you look at the systems and rules, I mean, a lot of it's for combat. You know, that's kind of what the game is when you're playing the game, you know. And we do all this role-playing stuff above and beyond that, which makes it much, much more fun and everything. But the game itself, it's about combat. So I'm cool with that. And, you know, combats can be fun as long as they're, you know, not just boring combat. So I'm trying to make every encounter like this really cool, like something from a Star Wars movie encounter, you know, or an Indiana Jones movie or something, you know, where there's like, you're in some crazy location or there's some crazy environmental things going on, adding challenge to the encounter, or they're just in this cool place, or fighting against really bizarre creatures or whatever. Just trying to, you know, cherry pick each level. Like, you know, here's all the creatures I could use for encounters in this level. I've got 5 encounters I can do. So what are the 5 coolest things that I can do at this level? And that's what I'm going to do. And this is, I don't know, it's a very gamist, I guess, way to approach it, because I'm usually more from a story. Like, I have a story I want to tell, and I come up with encounters that fit that story. But I'm just like, I want to see 5th edition, you know? I want to take a real good tour of it. And what better way than to go through this monster manual and pick all the monsters I think are the coolest and most interesting and use them in an adventure and just come up with a story to fit the monsters I want to use. And the thing that's kind of, I hope, bring this together and make it make sense and not just be dumb is that in my world, adventuring is a career. And I want to think of a term for it. This is how I'm going to do it. I'll maybe delete this later, but here's a secret how I'm going to do this. Is I'm just going to Google, let's see, adventurer, I guess, right? And get to the thesauruses and look for synonyms of adventurer and hope I find some inspiration and just go down any rabbit holes into historical stuff or whatever and find some term that conveys what I want to convey and hopefully isn't a pathfinder or a hunter or... It's definitely not going to be a witcher because that doesn't really even make sense in D&D, but, you know, isn't something else, you know. But those are inspirations and kind of what I'm thinking. These adventurers are inherently magical because in some way, shape, or form in your career as an adventurer, you use magic. And in this world, as soon as you touch magic, it touches you back. I mean, it changes you and you're never quite the same again, and or at least that's what people believe. And so people tend to not ostracize but tend to kind of keep people like that at arm's reach because they're not totally human anymore. They're not like us, kind of thing, but they respect them, and these people protect them from all the horrible things in the world, so it's not like they spit on them or anything like that, and they also fear them. But there is kind of this tension there that I think will be fun to play with. But basically what these... So I've thought some more about my world, and I did recently a World Builder episode about some of it, but what I'm thinking is I talked about in the episode about how there's all this planar travel going on and there's creatures and beings coming all the time from other planes and other places. And usually they go on their way, but sometimes they stay or sometimes they leave other things behind or whatever. And what I've decided is that much of the world, because this world is huge, much of it is unexplored
wilderness at this time. And, you know, at some point in history, probably about any place in the world was something at some time, you know, like there's some civilization there, or some city there or something, because the world's so old. But at this time, most of it is wilderness, and that wilderness might be overlaying ruins of, you know, some civilization long ago or whatever. But within all this wilderness, there are little pockets of civilization, you know, like city states, basically, or maybe just cities, maybe not even city states. It's just like the city and the little bit of land around it. But they're all very isolated from one another. They're all far apart from one another, and they're all remote. Like the majority of the world is just, you know, no man's land, you know. And because of this, most people don't actually travel like we think of it, like on a horse or on foot or on a wagon or whatever, from one town to another, because it's just too dangerous. So the cities, and I don't know, like I want to have like small towns and villages, but I haven't totally figured out how they're going to work. But cities, what I'm thinking is they have portals. They maintain gates or portals to the other cities that they trade with or whatever. And these portals are very well defended. And I'm thinking about having the portals able to have like multiple destinations. So, you know, there might be one portal, but it can go to any of the cities that that city is friendly with. And, you know, the portals have to be maintained on both sides, right? So it's a mutual thing for two cities to have portals linking them. And these portals are very, very well defended, and they all have some kind of guardians, which these guardians are the most powerful things that that particular city can find to protect its portals. Because it's, you know, it's kind of like in the Middle Ages, like maintaining your wall, you know, was so important, because that's your line of defense, right? And in this world, I mean, they have walls too to maintain against, you know, the things out in the wilderness. But as far as protecting from other people, other sentients, that is protecting these portals. Because that's really, I mean, so you're not going to send an army across all this wilderness, you know, to attack another city, because it's too far and there's too many, you know, you'd lose so much of your army, unless they're just all badass and they're huge. I don't know. Maybe you could do it if you were all badass, but I don't think it's commonly done. You know, it'd be more a thing of gaining access through the portal and getting like small strike teams through and stuff like that. But yeah, so that's what I'm thinking as far as that. So I'm thinking that the portal guardians will oftentimes be kind of retired adventurers, you know, people who used to go out into the world. And that's where I was kind of getting with this is the adventurers are really, for the most part, the only people that commonly go out into the wilderness outside of the cities and the areas they control. And so a lot of times these guardians guarding these gates are adventurers that no longer want to voyage through the world and just want to enjoy the good life, enjoy all the riches and money they've made. Because basically the adventurers is like, there's all these ancient ruins and there's all these great treasures and things to find and powerful relics from other times and stuff. And so for those that have the ability and the courage to go out into the wilderness looking for those things, you know, if they find something, you know, they're kind of set for life. You know, you can get very rich and very, very powerful doing that if you live to enjoy the fruits of your labors. So there's definitely, you know, a motivation to go into that line of work, you could say. But of course, not everybody has what it takes. So I'm thinking, you know, that kind of a setup and that kind of thing going on in the world will, you know, make everything internally consistent so that, you know, we can have a fun beer and pretzels game and people can go out seeking an adventure and, you know, basically looking for horrors and monsters and things that are killing people and creating problems, you know, looking for those and taking them out. And then also, you know, if they have treasures, profiting from that, and also always on the lookout for, these ancient ruins that they can explore to, you know, find powerful magic items and stuff. And I think that's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to have a lot of the more powerful magic items be from like earlier ages, you know, because it, you know, I'm kind of trying to work as much as I can with what we have in the books and even more make it make sense than I think maybe it does in like Forgotten Realms. So, you know, people have talked about online and stuff. If you look at like the what guidelines we have for magical item creation and what that would cost a player character to do, and then you compare that with what magic items are worth on the market and, you know, what you could buy that item for and what you could sell that item for, there's no real profit there. So, you know, it doesn't really make sense how someone could make magic items and then sell them and like be able to make a living doing that. So then, you know, and I think the game was probably designed that way because, you know, we don't want something like you had in Kingmaker where people can just make fortunes just making and selling magic items, you know, because it's not really the game of D&D that most of us want to play, right? Like accounting the RPG or something. So I think it was probably like a design decision from a like a game play and balance point of view. But it makes you wonder, you know, in the setting, in the world, like how do you reconcile this, right? Like if it's not profitable to make magic items and sell them, you know, why, how, where are all these magic items coming from, right? And, you know, the only explanation I could ever come up with, because it's kind of been like this in D&D, I feel like, you know, like it seems like it was never like, oh, I can get rich by making magic items, because it was only so expensive and laborious to do, especially like the really good ones. So I kind of feel like the only reason I ever came up with anyway for why someone would do that, like in the setting, is for your own personal use, right? Like I really need a staff of power and I can't find one anywhere, so I'm gonna make one, you know. Or maybe my DM's really cool and let me make like something like a staff of power, but, you know, something more designed around my character and like the spells I like to use and stuff like that, you know, like that's really the only way it makes sense. And even then it's like, you know, it's a pretty big investment for that character, but it's like, hey, you get this magic item you really want. So it makes sense that like an adventurer would create a magic item, but it would mainly be items for them to use themselves. So I guess, you know, you could argue that, well, all the items in the world are just ones that adventurers had and, you know, they got killed or whatever. But I don't know. It's still, you know, it's like, it seems like there's too many items for that to be the only way they came about. You know, it seems like there had to have been a time where people made more items than they do today. I don't know. Or they made more powerful ones. And I guess what I'm kind of going in circles here, but what I'm getting around to is I think that I will say that like the more powerful magic items and the more kind of unique magic items will tend to be older, you know, and this is probably an item that was created maybe hundreds or even thousands of years ago. You know, because at any given time, there are very few people actually making magic items. And those magic items aren't going to go into any kind of circulation until after that person dies, because they're going to be using the magic item themselves, right? So, yeah, and, you know, it's kind of nice that the world is so old, because the older it is, the more it makes sense that there are just all these items laying around, right? And Forgotten Realms, you know, is pretty old. So Forgotten Realms might be old enough that it makes sense for items to be just laying around. I suppose it does. It's a very magical place too, though hopefully in a different way. All right. So Gibbering Mouther. Sorry, I'm getting on these huge tangents just talking to you. So I'm going to flip to my encounter design section in the DMG now. Page 82. I actually have these little, they're post-it little markers for your like little tabs for like putting in a book. So I use those to mark places in my books that I need to find. So I'm gonna have a party of four
players, I'm assuming. There may be five, there may be more, but I'm just going to assume four for now. And I need to know their XP thresholds. So I've actually already done this. And basically, this is on page 82. There's a little chart, XP thresholds by character level. And I have second level characters. I've got four of them. So second level, it's got numbers for easy, medium, hard, deadly, depending on how hard you want that particular encounter to be. So for instance, second level character, an easy encounter is 50 XP. Now that's per character. So you take these numbers and you times them by the number of players you have. So I multiplied them all by four. So for a party of four level two adventurers, an easy encounter is 200 XP, medium is 400, hard is 600, and deadly is 800. So I now am going to look at this gibbering mouther that I love so much. He is 450 XP. So that is a medium encounter by himself. 450 XP. Medium is at 400, hard is at 600. So I could theoretically maybe add a much lower level minion to him and get up into a hard encounter. And I kind of would like to make it hard just so that I'm sure it's challenging, because I think this guy is scary. But he seems pretty badass by himself. I mean, I could see using him as like they're having an encounter with something else and they just like, as they're fighting this other thing, they go into the Mouther's like territory or whatever. And so now they have to deal with the Mouther too. But I feel like in an encounter with this guy and any of the other things I have access to right now, like this guy might kind of steal the show. And the encounter kind of becomes about the Mouther, not the thing they were fighting before. I'd kind of rather, if I'm going to beef this up to a hard, I'd rather do it by making him more badass and just have the one monster that they face. That's really how I'm seeing this encounter right now. I'm just seeing them facing this gibbering Mouther, and that's it. And it's just straight up horror, this thing coming after him. And I like the idea of him just being really hard to kill and just really scary. Like, not only just the way he looks and the concept, but actually the fact that it seems like he could kill your character. So I can definitely beef him up. I'm trying to remember if we have any guidelines for that in the system, as far as like what that would add to his XP value. Like if I gave him, I don't know, a hit die or something. The other problem with adding other, like some minions with them, is as soon as you go beyond one creature, there are multipliers that you apply, because, you know, more and more creatures is harder beyond just the additive value of their CRs because of the economy of action. And the bad guys have so many more actions in a turn than the PCs have, and they can't like overcome that, you know. So that's why that multiplier's in there. So what I'm saying is to be able to add one or two other things and have it not go into a deadly encounter with the multiplier figured in, I'd probably have to go with like really, really weak stuff to the point of, is it really worth it? Although, after saying that, I'm not sure what the CR is on them. But if I really wanted to up the pucker factor on this, I could always round this out with some Sturges. Facing this guy and some Sturges at the same time, that would be scary. I don't know what a Sturge CR is. Maybe they're like a half or a quarter or something, in which case I could maybe do that and my players will hate me forever. Sturges are scary. Here's an encounter with some Sturges in Horde of the Dragon Queen, and that was going pretty rough for the PCs. Sturge. 1/8, 25 XP. Yeah, there we go. Let's see. Sturges are... Oh, do they not in this edition have, like, what terrain they're found in? I thought they did. I guess not. They do have, in the DMG, they have tables by terrain. But in the actual entry for the monster, I don't see where it gives you a terrain. It really surprises me. Maybe it's in the text. Nope. Yeah, Sturges are really short entry. It's half of a page. Oh, well, I think they can find be found pretty much anywhere. It's my world. I do what I want. Some gate could have just opened and a bunch of Sturges flew out. So they are 25 XP apiece. So now I start thinking about how many Sturges could I add to my Mouther? That sounds so not PG. Anyway, to make my encounter hard but not deadly. So I want to get over 600, but I don't want to get to 800. So somewhere between 600 and 799 is what I'm shooting for. The Mouther by himself was what was it, 450? Can you tell me? Shout it out there. 450. Yeah. So the Mouther's 450. I'm writing this down so I don't forget it again. 450 XP. And Sturges, 25 XP. So just to see first kind of where we're at mathematically. Where's my calculator? Let's see if I just added one, what that's going to do to our XP. So the Mouther is 450. Sturges 25, that's 475. We are now at two monsters, so we times that by 1.5, the encounter multiplier. So that's 712.5 XP. That's in our range right there. So we wanted to be above 600 but below 800. I wonder if I add another Mouther if I'm going to be above 800. I think it's possible I might be. Because while I go up to a higher multiplier, I will. It goes up to times two. So let's see. So 450 for the Mouther, and then 25 for each Sturge, and we're going to have two of them. So that's 500 right there. And then our multiplier is now two times two, because we now have three creatures times two is 1,000, which is into deadlies at 800. So you see, you know, you're like, okay, I've got a Gibbering Mouther and I'm going to add a Sturge, this little eighth CR creature, you know, worth 25 XP. And you check your math and you're like, okay, that's in hard. And it's not up into deadly yet. And you might think, oh, well, surely I can add another Sturge and I won't be deadly because it's only another eighth CR, you know, 25 XP. But the thing is your multiplier went up. You know, if it's just one monster, then the XP is what it is, obviously. It's not, you know, it's the standard difficulty. But if it's two monsters, then the XP is times 1.5 as far as figuring out encounter balance, not as far as the XP you reward to players. This is just for encounter balancing. But then if you have 3 to 6 monsters, the XP is doubled times 2. 7 to 10 is times 2.5, 11 to 14 is times 3, and then 15 monsters or more is times 4. So when you cross that threshold between one multiplier and another, it, you know, it's a big difference. So in this case, adding one Sturge brought me to hard, but not quite deadly, but adding two Sturges takes me way, way into deadly, like 200 beyond what I needed for deadly. So two would definitely be too much. So I think what I can do here is this will be fun. So I really want the Mouther to be, you know, a scary thing by itself. I think that it will be. I think if I set the scene well and I describe it well and really role play it, I think it will be scary. And then when they engage with it, I think mechanically it's strong enough that it will be scary. But if things start to go south on my end of the table and the PCs are just laying into this thing and they're making all the saves and they're just like gonna annihilate it, I can bring the Sturge in and just have the Sturge show up. And I can come up with ahead of time like how that works and where the Sturge came from and why the Sturge is there. And then that way I can kind of in the game, you know, I can decide during play if I want to use the Sturge or not. And if it looks like it's going to be a challenging encounter with just the Gibbering Mouther, then I can just do that. Or what I could do is if, you know, if I'm happy with just how things are going with the Mouther and I'm like, okay, this is challenging. You know, I think ultimately the PCs will win, but it's tense and, you know, it's uncertain and that's cool. Like, I'm not going to bring the Sturge in and risk like, oh, now it's too much and they're dying, you know.
But what I might do is, you know, if they defeat the Mauther and they're not like real beat up, or, you know, I feel they can handle it, I might throw the Sturge at them like right away, like have the Sturge show up in the last round or something. So they maybe only for a round or two have to deal with both at the same time, or maybe they, you know, they don't have to deal with both at the same time at all. But having like, okay, I have these two encounters. I have the Gibbering Mauther and then I have the Sturge, and having the Sturge be kind of more fluid where I'm like, okay, I think of how it could come in to the Gibbering Mauther encounter either while, you know, during the encounter or right after it. And then if I don't use either of those, then I also, you know, maybe have an idea of how I could use it later. Or, you know, it seems like the Sturge is easy to just use anytime because it's a flying creature. You can find it anywhere. It's really small, so it could have easily been in the background and you didn't notice it. And especially if they're out in the open air at all, I mean, a Sturge can just show up at any time. So that's pretty cool. I dig that. So that's my first encounter. So I have an encounter with a Gibbering Mauther and a Sturge. All right, and with that, I think I will wrap up episode 64 of Game Master's Journey. There will be another part in this. I continue working on this first adventure. I do a few more encounters and have some more discussion of just encounter creation and how it all works in D&D 5th edition. So if you want to hear the second part of this, definitely check out episode 65. If you'd like to reach me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Google+, just search for Lex Starwalker, and follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Please visit my website, starwalkerstudios.com. There you can find the show notes for Game Master's Journey. You can also find my other podcasts there. Right now I am producing another show called Expanse, the unofficial podcast. I do that with my wife, Nikki. And it's all about, you guessed it, The Expanse, which the first episode of that, of the TV show, I should say, is going to be available Monday, the 23rd of November online. And then the show launches on the Sci-Fi Channel December 14th and 15th. So we are spooling up for that. And we've been talking about the various actors and characters of the TV show and the books. And our episode for next week, we're going to be talking about the pilot episode of the TV show. Once again, I want to remind you that if you would like to support this show, a great way to do so is by becoming a patron like Steven Strickland did. And you can find out more about that by just clicking the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. Also, in the show notes at the top, we have a donate button if you'd prefer just to give a one-time donation. And I really, really appreciate all the patrons and all the listeners who donate. You guys are the cream of the crop that keeps this going for everyone. Thank you so much. Also, at the bottom of the show notes, you can sign up for the new Starwalker Studios newsletter. I will at most send out one email a month, just letting you know what's going on with the studio, if we have any new shows coming out, or what's going on with the shows we've already got coming out, just things like that. So you can find all this and more at the website, starwalkerstudios.com. So I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back next time with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Tranceboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.